but then he jerked to a stop as surely as if he'd run into a stone wall. Abby was 30 feet back and nearly ran into Ji Wu, who was just ahead of her. Everyone stopped. And Burke seemed not only to have stopped, but appeared to hang in midair, his kicking feet inches above the ground. Abby pushed past the others and was 10 feet from Burke when he began to scream. At first glance, she thought he'd hit a network of those slender, translucent vines and gotten entangled, but it wasn't that at all. Riley, who was closest to Burke, suddenly let out a scream as shrill and high-pitched as a little girl's. Then all of them were screaming. Ji-Woo blocked Abby's line of sight momentarily, and as Abby tried to step around her and see Burke, Ji-Woo staggered back, flailing her arms in panic as she tried to simultaneously back up, turn, and run. She failed at all three and instead crashed into Abby. They both fell, but Ji-Woo was up again and stepped on Abby's stomach in a mad rush to escape. Uttering cries like a terrified child, Ji-Woo ran back the way they had come, leaving Abby winded in pain, sprawled on the floor. The other technicians scattered, some of them running into the dense jungle foliage. Riley vanished behind a row of desks that were covered in glistening moss. Abby watched as Connie tripped over a fallen log and then screamed as she looked down, likely realizing that it wasn't a log at all, but a body wrapped in hairy vines. There were a few inches of crushed skin, one open eye that was glazed and sightless. The corpse's mouth was open too, and tendrils seemed to tunnel down into its throat. The sight seemed to snap something in Connie. She started to get up, then simply dropped to her knees and grabbed her hair with both fists, as if she wanted or needed to tear it out by the roots. She screamed and screamed and screamed. And now Abby could see Burke again. He still hung there in midair. Hung. Not on vines. No. Vines, even thorny ones, would have been okay. They could have dealt with that. The things that held Burke's thrashing body were not plant matter of any kind. Each strand was thinner than the thinnest of the vines they'd seen. They looked like steel wires. But that's not what they were, either. Abby, gasping, the breath punched from her lungs by Jiwoo's feet, had to force her mind to accept what those wires actually were. Not vines, not wires. They were strands of silk. Even though Abby did not want to believe that, she had to. When the bright red spiders warmed all over Burke, up his body, inside his cuffs, down his shirt, and into his open, screaming mouth, Abby had to. Chapter 22. The Pierce Tower, the climb. It took 1,000 years to climb to the top of the building, maybe longer. Every second felt like an eternity to David. His muscles ached with the burn of lactic acid, his hands were numb, and he fought for breath more urgently than if he was high in the Himalayas. He knew it was shock and stress, and worked to control his breathing. Blacking out was a real threat, and he'd already taken several hard hits from the pulses. The adrenaline that had shotgunned into his bloodstream when the bird attacked him was processing through him, making him jumpy, messing with his light perception, working his heart too much. This was neither fight nor flight, not this part. He needed cold precision in order to be accurate and safe, but even tethered to the pitons, David felt like he was falling or about to. It took much longer to climb the rest of the way up because he knew, he could feel, how close he was to totally losing his shit. He'd been in firefights so intense that seasoned soldiers were reduced to screaming wrecks, curled into fetal balls in their foxholes, arms wrapped over their heads. He'd had a Humvee blown out around him as it rolled over an IED, and spent hours trying to pull the corpses of his squad out of burning, twisted metal. He'd hung from a rope on the side of the Rupal face of Nangna Parbat in Pakistan on the 15,000-foot climb known as the Man-Eater, watching as his best friend fell and fell and fell, twisting in the wind, trailing a shredded rope all the way down to the unforgiving ground. All those moments and more. Before tonight, David used to joke that he was ready for anything. But as he climbed, Looking at the building he saw reflected in the glass, the city he loved become a place of madness, monsters, and horrors. While inside, Abby was fighting for her life and fighting to save a world that was not breaking apart, but instead becoming a jigsaw puzzle of unbearable realities. There was no way to prepare for that. No way at all. He climbed anyway, through the endless forever of each new step, each level gained. And now he stood on the lip of the window of the top floor, the 58th floor, his feet braced on the edge of the shattered window. From below, before his climb, he'd seen fires burning up here. He'd seen the way in. Except now he understood. The fires had been reflections of the burning city, gleaming on the jagged teeth of safety glass and on the steel face of the interior shutters. The window was destroyed, the steel shutters dented. And that was all. There was no way in. No way in at all. Part 3. The Masks We Wear. We often give our enemies the means for our own destruction. Aesop. Chapter 23. The Pierce Tower, 53rd floor. The spiders were each the size of golf balls, their fat bodies gleaming as if freshly painted. It was not a blood red, no. They were all a bright carnival red, a cartoon red, though there was nothing funny or entertaining about them. They scuttled along the swaying strands of their web and over Burke's arms and legs and chest and face. Burke screamed as long as he could, until his mouth and his throat were so choked with them that his screams became a muffled cry and then a gurgle. And then nothing at all. It happened so fast. Burke was alive and then he wasn't. Before today, Abby had never seen a person die. Not really. It had all been in movies or in documentaries about war. Never in front of her eyes, and certainly not someone she knew and liked. Not exactly a friend, but a likable fellow employee. Someone she saw every working day. One of the crowd that went out for pizza and beer. A scientist and a decent human being. Gone now. Like her lab assistant, Connor, a young grad student who tried to reason with the alien hunter. He'd raised his hands, showing that he held no weapons. He'd approached slowly, tried to make peaceful contact, and the hunter had killed him, decapitated him. Connor. And now Burke. Again, the slowing of time seemed to lose its elasticity and snap back into place. And again, Abby was moving before she knew she could. She came up off the floor, taking the axe in both hands, raising it, rushing forward as more of the red spiders crawled over Burke's limp body. She screamed so loud it shocked everyone and everything to silence and immobility. Even the spiders paused to turn their many eyes toward her as Abby muscled past the other techs. The gleaming blade rose and fell, cleaving through the web. It was like cutting through rubber. She parted only one strand on the first cut, but then she cut again and again, hacking at the barrier between her people and the exit door. Spiders fell to the ground. Some landed badly and burst apart, spilling yellow-green goo onto the floor. Others fled into the foliage. Some raced toward her, maybe trying to flee, maybe trying to attack. With a groan of disgust, Abby stamped down, smashing them. And suddenly another foot did the same. Rosa, her dark eyes wild with terror, started stomping on the spiders. She wore low-heeled pumps, and her feet moved faster and faster, crushing the spiders that ran toward Abby's legs. Abby kept chopping at the web. It was huge, filling the whole back end of the analytics room. There were other shapes there, caught on strands, hanging, dying, or dead. An animal like a raccoon, except with porcupine quills and cat claws. A pair of helmet-sized turtles with shells covered in rainbow-colored mosaics. A small monkey with the fangs of a snake. Other things too exotic for comparisons with anything she knew. And bodies. Four of them, wrapped in cocoons of silk, teeming with spiders. silent and still. It was a small mercy that the webbing hid their faces. Only four, though. She had no idea where the others were. Maybe trapped in some other web elsewhere in this jungle, or brought down by something else, perhaps one of those giant centipedes. "Help us!" yelled Rosa. And a moment later, Riley was there, lunging forward to stamp and grind and crush. A high-pitched whistling sound cut through their screams, and suddenly the spiders stopped swarming. They turned, as if listening, and then they vanished into the foliage. With the spiders gone and some of the webs parted, Burke's body slipped down almost to the ground. Only a few strands held his head and shoulders up, and from that angle it looked like his dead eyes were watching Abby. She wanted to look away. She wanted to cry. Instead, she raised the axe and chopped at another strand and another. There were other things here to be afraid of, and her mind already felt cracked and fragile. As she tugged her axe free from the sticky webs, she saw the face of her wristwatch. It shocked her. Less than an hour had passed since she and Mike Castro had started up in the elevator. How was that possible? An hour? Was that really all it took for the world to fall apart? Burke's dead eyes stared accusingly at her. "I'm sorry," she whispered, to him, to everyone caught up in this horror. "I'm so sorry." The whistling sound faded out and vanished, and for a moment there was total silence. Abby expected the insect noises to resume, but they did not. "Thank God," breathed Riley, but Rosa shook her head. "Something scared those spiders off," she said in a frightened whisper. Riley gaped at her. "What the hell could scare them?" "I don't want to find out," growled Abby, as she pushed between them and attacked the last strands of the web with renewed ferocity. "We need to get out of here. The power's on, so the elevator should be working." She swung the axe and cleaved through more strands of webbing. Rosa, unarmed, stood by and watched, her eyes flicking into the shadows beneath the towering plants. The other techs crept out of the jungle, one of them supporting a nearly catatonic Connie. One person was missing, though. "Riley, can you see Jiwoo anywhere?" Abby asked between swings.
"No."
"You didn't see where she ran?"
No.
The others shook their heads, too. The piercing whistle came again. Louder. Or maybe closer.
"Jesus, what is that?" said Riley.
"I don't know," said Abby, "and I don't want to find out."
She cut and cut as the whistling sound grew louder. And behind that, far away on the other side of the analytics room, beyond the dense and impossible jungle, there was another sound, a cracking noise, and then the tortured shriek of twisting metal. There were snuffing sounds, too, a weird mix of dog and cat sounds. The Hellcats were breaking into the room. The hunter was coming for them. Abby began chopping faster, harder. The strands parted, and then the path to the exit door was free. "Come on," she yelled, and bolted for the door. The whistle rose higher and higher as something heavy moved through the room, smashing into desks, sending computers crashing to the floor, tearing through the plants. Abby turned to see a huge, bulky creature burst into the open. It was as big as a full-grown bull, but there was nothing remotely bovine about it. The creature had a low, wide skull, with horns pointing backward and down from the back of its head. Instead of a mouth, it had a hard beak, which was opened in a roar that showed rows of small, needle-sharp teeth. The massive body was covered in armor plates, and behind it swung a thick tail that ended with a heavy club. Abby was already so stunned that it was hard to process another impossibility, and yet this was something from her own childhood. Before she'd fallen in love with physics, she'd filled her bedroom with posters and books and statues of creatures from this earth. Megafauna and dinosaurs. And this creature was something that had died out when an asteroid slammed into the earth more than 60 million years ago. Even through her shock, the name came easily. An ankylosaur. And big as this thing was, it was far smaller than the 6-meter-long specimens she'd seen in museums. It was a baby, driven mad with panic, It charged forward, but Abby could see that its eyes were not focused on her or the text. It cast about, looking for anywhere safe. It was running from the whistle, fleeing from creatures that it never encountered, the hunter and her pack. Abby shoved Rosa aside as Riley dragged Connie to safety behind a weed-covered file cabinet and then pulled her down, protecting her with his lean body. The others of their party flung themselves into the bushes to avoid the frantic charge of the baby dinosaur. Riley got to his knees and watched the thing smash through another section of webbing and then disappear down a hallway to the bathrooms. There was the sound of metal bending and porcelain shattering.
"This is nuts," said Riley as he helped Connie up.
Abby saw that he wore a wondering smile on his face. Had he snapped too? Or was he simply caught in the moment? Then the first of the Hellcats came pelting up the path through the jungle.
"Move, move!" yelled Abby, turning, shoving everyone toward the exit door.
Riley spun Connie and shoved her forward. She stumbled numbly at first and then seemed to come back to herself and began to run. She hit the door first and banged it open. Riley was only a step behind her, and he began grabbing sleeves and wrists to pull people through into the hall. Abby looked around for Ji-Woo, but she was nowhere in sight.
"Please," she begged. "Ji-Woo, please."
The Hellcat was racing toward them, its evil yellow cat eyes burning with the anticipation of catching prey. It was heavier than a cheetah and nearly as fast. Abby backed quickly toward the exit, axe raised.
"Out, out, out," she cried. "Hurry!"
The Hellcat was 20 yards away, moving like a blur. Abby could see more of the creatures racing to catch up, and then the armored nightmare that was the hunter striding behind them, its spear held up and pointing at her. The piercing whistle seemed to be coming from the weapon.
"Abby,"
yelled Riley,
"we're clear."
"I can't see Ji-Woo.
There's no time."
Hands reached out and pulled her backward with such force that she stumbled and fell, landing on her butt and sliding into the hall. Riley and another tech slammed the door and hit the big red lockdown button. The 6 10-inch reinforced steel bars shot out of the frame, and a second later, the Hellcat slammed against the other side. The impact was so hard that the animal shrieked in pain.
"God," thought Abby, "is this how it's going to be? Chased from floor to floor, room to room? What happens when we run out of doors to shut?"
It was a pointless question. The answer was obvious. Unless she was able to turn off the entire power grid and shut down that threshold, the world as she knew it would be gone forever. But even then, would resetting the system stop all of this? Would doing that rip this patchwork world apart and restore all these things to where they came from? She wanted to believe that, needed to, even though she was pretty sure that she was trying to sell herself a lie. Chapter 24. The Pierce Tower, 58th floor. Senior security specialist Mike Castro knelt behind the gateway machine and tried to prepare himself for death. He had his 9mm automatic clutched in both hands, his right index finger lying along the curve of the trigger guard. Castro had no idea how many rounds were left, and he did not dare drop the magazine to check because that would make noise. He did not dare make a sound, not even to use his walkie-talkie. The fact that no one else from the security team had come into the chamber was not a good sign, though he had no idea what might have happened to the other guards. Castro also didn't dare peer around the machine. He could still hear things moving, and none of the sounds were from shoes or sneakers. They were bizarre, clickety, slithery noises. He didn't think it was the woman in the armor. She'd been wearing boots. Was it more of those freaky dogs, or God Almighty, that centipede? The thought of either absolutely terrified him. The weapon, which had always been a heavy weight on his gun belt or an inconvenient bulk in his shoulder holster, now felt absurdly small and ineffectual, like a cap pistol. His rounds had done nothing at all to the armor that woman wore. Shooting her just pissed her off. Would it do any better with the dog things?
From somewhere far off, not in that room, he could hear a whistle of some kind, and roaring sounds. It sounded too big for the dog things, too deep-chested. His hands were slick with sweat, and he had to shift the gun first to one hand and then the other so he could wipe his hands dry. He heard a soft sound and looked up to see a dragonfly land atop the machine. It looked entirely normal, like any such insect he saw every summer when he took his son fishing at Clove Lakes Park on Staten Island. Except this one had a wingspan of at least 2.5 feet. The creature looked down at him, its antenna moving slowly. Mike Castro thought it was the most beautiful thing he'd ever seen. And for a freakish moment, he wondered if it was an angel come to lift him from all this and take him to heaven. It radiated purity and innocence. The pistol in his hands rose almost of its own volition, the barrel shaking only a little. The antenna stopped twitching. Castro's fingers curled into the trigger guard. Then the dragonfly launched itself from the machine, up and away, out of sight, not at Castro. He sagged backward, so thoroughly he nearly dropped the gun. He fumbled at hand to chest, to arm, to chin, to chest, and finally caught it. He drew in a breath and released it, almost as a laugh. Caught that too. "Focus, focus, focus," he repeated inside his head. Then there was a new sound, a heavy, muffled thud, again and again. Castro followed the direction of the sounds, and with a jolt, realized that they were coming from outside. "What the hell?" He crabbed sideways along the wall beneath the row of massive steel blast shields that had been dropped inside the windows when the tower went into lockdown. He found the panel where the pounding was loudest and leaned close to listen. Then he grunted as he realized that the pounding was not random. There were sets of blows, three sets of three, followed by a pause. He almost laughed when he realized what it was. Three fast hits, three heavier, spaced blows. And then three more quick ones. Three dots, three dashes, three dots. SOS. "Holy shit," he breathed. Somebody was outside, but on the 58th floor? On any other day in his entire life, that would be too weird for words, too hard to believe. Castro licked his lips. Now what? He wanted to signal the person. He didn't know any Morse code beyond SOS. What would work then? Pounding back? How? Maybe in any kind of pattern, he thought. That would let whoever was outside know that it wasn't just random noise. Okay, then what? If it was SWAT, and he prayed to baby Jesus that it wasn't like there was a lever to pop the window open. There were a couple of tons of steel in each panel. The pounding could get through, but only just. Besides, Castro didn't want to risk making noise. Which is when he realized that this caution was already ill-considered and too late. He was crouching right below the loudest source of noise in the room. The clicking sound came from behind him. Castro threw himself sideways, turning, bringing the gun up as something dark rushed at him. The muzzle flash illuminated a face out of a nightmare. It reared above him on its hind legs, standing as tall as a grown bull elephant, covered in coarse brown fur. The titanic body was all muscle and blubber and had to weigh close to 2 tons. It was a gigantic bear, with an oddly shortened snout but massive fangs and claws. There was fresh snow caked on its shoulders, melting now in the heat from the scattered fires that still burned. God only knew from which world it had come, or maybe the distant past. Castro had no idea and no time to make sense of it. The monstrous bear spread its arms, and its shadow fell across him and cast him into darkness. He pointed the gun. He fired, and he screamed. Chapter 25. The Pierce Tower, the climb. David stopped pounding on the steel shutter. His fist hurt. Sending the SOS had been a desperate tactic because he had no plan B. He'd come all this way thinking he was going to gallop to the rescue, but now he felt like a fool and a helpless one at that. He fished for his phone and tried calling Abby, but it went straight to voicemail. David tried the police again. Not even voicemail. No internet access either. He tried to make some sense of the situation. The Pierce Tower was thoroughly protected. A few years back, Abby had made a comment that the tower could withstand a nuclear blast. At the time, he thought she was joking, but now David wondered if she'd been telling the truth. Over the years, he'd caught snatches of things she said in calls to the people at work, never from eavesdropping, but they did share an apartment. He'd once heard her say, "Won't be like Fukushima or 3 Mile Island," and, "The idea is no matter what happens, it'll stay inside the tower. That's how I designed it." Factoring it in with what Abby told him a little while ago, he had a rough idea of how formidable a challenge getting in was going to be. The part of him that was weary from the climb and frightened by what was happening wanted to find somewhere to rest, maybe to hide. But the part of him that was both a seasoned Tier 1 special operator and also in love with Abby needed to figure this out. "Get your shit together, soldier," he said out loud. The wind tried to steal those words and their meaning away, but David held on to them. Abby needed him. Maybe the whole damn city needed him. He looked down at the ground, what he could see beyond the curve of the tower, and saw things moving down there. Big, ungainly animals. From 58 stories up, they looked tiny, but when they walked past his jeep, the scale became apparent. They were at least as big as elephants, maybe bigger. He pulled his binoculars from his pack, braced his feet to steady himself, and looked again. Suddenly, the creatures came into focus, and he damn near dropped the binoculars. The creatures below were not elephants, or rhinos, hippos, or anything else that might have escaped from a zoo. No. These creatures moved with the slow deliberation of cattle, but the shapes and sizes were all wrong. Their heads swung back and forth on muscular necks, and they had slender crests that curled backward from the skull almost to their shoulders. Massive tails swung back and forth like counterweights. Even with the binoculars, it was hard to tell if they walked on two legs or four, but their thick bodies were bent sharply forward. David swallowed hard. He recognized them from similar creatures he'd seen in one of the Jurassic Park movies, but he couldn't produce a name. He hadn't been into dinosaurs when he was a kid, but David was pretty sure he was seeing a small herd of herbivores that should have been extinct for millions of years. "Jesus," he said, but at the same time he managed a small smile. The creatures below, even from this distance, looked gentle, like cows. That was such an important thing for him to see, to know, because it meant that whatever was happening wasn't entirely bad or entirely destructive. Maybe that was a flimsy lifeline to grab, but it helped. It helped a lot. Though in ways David couldn't fully understand and had no time to explore. Then he saw something else down there. Something he would never have noticed had one of the placid dinosaurs not walked over the edge of one. The oblong moved under its weight, and that scared the creature. The animal shied away, causing the others to move too. "What the hell?" murmured David, as he trained the glasses on that dark shape. Whatever it was, the object was heavy, and it wobbled ponderously for a moment or two before becoming still again. David fought to steady his hands, which were beginning to shake again, not with fear this time, but hope. "No," he breathed, but what he meant was yes. Those three oblongs down there were big, easily 10 by 12 feet, a calculation based on the size of nearby parked cars. They were each twisted slightly out of shape, which explained why one of them had rocked when the dinosaur stepped on it. He turned and looked behind him. At the massive 10 by 12 foot steel shutters in each window. The ones here were intact. Those down there, and he was positive they were shutters, had to come from some other window. Where, though? David tried to remember where the winds were when the first pulse hit, and was sure they were blowing away from the river, the last of the storm winds. So if the shutters were there, and assuming the wind shoved them as they fell, then logic dictated they came from his right. From around the corner on the other side of the tower. David smiled again, turned into a grin, and then broke as a laugh bubbled out of his chest. There was a way in, and some big old dumb dinosaur had schooled him on where to look. If he ever got out of this, past this madness, and the world became his world again, David swore that he would find out what dinosaurs they were and have one tattooed on his chest near his heart. He looked along the line of windows to his left, set his jaw, and grabbed for a new piton. Chapter 26. The Pierce Tower, 58th floor. Dr. Jacqueline Sloan crawled through the air duct on bruised knees. Tears ran from her eyes and splatted on the cold aluminum. Every now and then a sob caught in her throat, and she tried to hide them with fake coughs. She didn't know the names of the men who followed her. One was Asian, one was black, and that was enough for her. "Turn left ahead," called the black man who was 10 feet behind her.
"How do you know that's the correct turn?" she demanded.
"Because that's the direction of the fire tower. There are vents on every floor."
"There's a fucking tree in the fucking fire tower," snarled Sloan. A beat, then.
"Yes, Dr. Sloan, but there will be a down vent. We can lower ourselves to 57, then get into the stairwell beneath the obstruction."
She stopped and looked over her shoulder. "Do you know this, or are you guessing?"
"Guessing," came the reply, but then he added, "Has to be, though. That's how these ducts work."
"There might be a fan," said the Asian man.
"Sure," said the black man, "but we'll deal with that. I mean, listen, do you hear a fan? I don't. It means they're turned off."
"Still going to block the way," countered the Asian man.
"Okay, but it's a fan set into aluminum with screws. How hard can it be to kick it loose?"
Sloan pointed a stiff finger at him.
"You'd damn well better be right."
For a moment, it looked as if the black man was going to say something back, maybe some smart-ass comment, but he closed his mouth. His eyes were eloquent, though, and were filled with a great deal of loathing. That was fine. Sloan didn't give a damn about either of them, and certainly cared nothing in terms of their opinions of her. To hell with both of them. Sloan just needed to get the hell out of these vents and find a safe place and a working phone. Her cell was not in the pocket of her lab coat, and she had no idea where it was. Probably in the gateway chamber, which meant it might as well have been on the far side of Jupiter. And she'd already asked them if they had cells, but neither did. None of the support staff had been allowed to bring cell phones into the chamber. Benjamin didn't want pics of the threshold showing up on anyone's Instagram or Twitter page. Plan A was to find any phone with service that could get a signal through the building's lockdown shielding. If that didn't work, then Plan B would be to make her way to any of the building's 4 security substations, where she was certain there would be walkie-talkies or maybe even a satellite phone. If she could make her call, then the goddamn cavalry would come riding to her rescue. Her head ached and her knees hurt, but she began crawling again. At the junction, she did, in fact, turn left. Chapter 27. The Pierce Tower, 53rd floor. Rosa rushed over to the elevator and began stabbing the button, but nothing happened. She leaned an ear to the door as Abby hurried over to join her.
"Anything?"
Rosa closed her eyes and seemed to listen harder. Then she exhaled and pushed off from the door.
"Nothing."
They looked at the others. Jiwoo's absence was conspicuous. So was Burke's. Their group was dwindling, and each loss hurt. Each loss was frightening, because it painted a clearer picture of how bad things really were. The rest of the techs were clustered around Riley, who stood with his palms against the door, head bowed. Either in an effort to reinforce the door against the new barrage of pounding, or maybe in defeat, or in prayer, it was impossible to say. Abby and Rosa kept their voices low.
"We need to take these stairs down," said Abby.
Rosa glanced down the short hall to the fire tower door. We don't know what's down there.
We know what's up here, though, said Abby. And we know what will happen when that hunter and her dogs get in here.
This is all insane, right, Abby? I mean, you understand that this is just plain impossible.
But Abby shook her head.
Nothing that's impossible ever happens.
Okay, sure, quote a science 101 textbook at me.
No, Rosa, said Abby quickly. I'm not trying to be an ass. If it's happening, then it's possible. And if it's possible, there has to be some kind of structure of reality around it. Physical laws. Archimedes' principle, Avogadro's law, Ohm's law, the law of conservation of energy, Newtonian laws, relativity, hell, gravity. What I'm saying is that we're all scientists, and we're acting like clueless victims. We need to act like scientists. We need to think this through, reason it out. We can't just keep running. We need to observe and learn.
She pointed to the analytics room on the other side of the wall.
We didn't do anything smart in there. We panicked and people died. We can't be lemmings running off a cliff.
That's a myth, said Rosa. It came out of some Disney movie. Lemmings don't commit mass suicide, but yeah, I get your point. We have enough advanced degrees to choke a horse, and yet we're screaming and running.
Yes, said Abby.
But let's face it, said Rosa. There was a lot to run from.
No argument. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have run. Self-preservation is smart. I have the axe. I should have gone first. I'd have seen the web and cut through it, and Burke might still be alive.
Okay, no, said Rosa, shaking her head. If you'd cut the web, those spiders would have swarmed all over you.
We don't know that, said Abby. Burke was caught when he tried to run through the webs. If I started cutting, maybe they wouldn't have attacked.
Sure, because giant mutant spiders are reasonable, said Rosa.
It would have been a better plan, countered Abby. And besides, we were just running. No one saw the spider webs because we weren't looking for anything like that.
How could we? Asked Rosa.
Because we opened a threshold to another world, a lot of other worlds, said Abby. We've already seen that hunter, her dogs, and that centipede. We saw all kinds of unknown animals as soon as we got into the analytics room. We were so caught up in shock, we forgot to observe. I mean, really, Rosa, who better than us to expect anomalous things?
Rosa studied her for a long moment, then nodded.
Okay, well, what are we observing now that we can use?
Abby pointed to the stairs.
I say we go down a couple of flights and check each floor. The first one that looks clear, we run through and get to the other fire tower. We do the same thing, find a clear floor and run through. Make it hard for that woman and her dogs to chase us. Maybe run all the way to the end, then run back and go down. What do they call it? Doubling back? Confuse the scent?
Rosa kept nodding.
Okay. And there's a custodial closet on all the even-numbered floors. Maybe they'll have something we can use. Mop and broom handles for weapons. And chemicals? Doesn't bleach mess with dogs' noses? I saw that on a mystery show. CSI or some shit. Use that to keep them from knowing which trail to follow.
That's good, said Abby excitedly. That's really good. Okay, let's go. We'll tell the others while we're on the stairs.
Chapter 28 The Pierce Tower, 46th floor. Dr. Benjamin did not realize he'd fallen asleep until voices woke him up. He was at a cross junction in the vents, and had paused because there were simply too many directions to take, and he didn't want to take the wrong one, so he took none. He was so tired. No, more than tired. He was completely exhausted. He was a very tall man, and moving through these cramped spaces was awkward and painful and slow. It felt so lost that for a while he lay curled in a ball and wept. He had, in fact, cried himself to sleep. The voices, though, snapped him back to reality. There were three people talking, two male voices and one female. It took a while for him to orient himself and identify from which direction the voices came. Below him and to his left. Close, too. Almost close enough to understand what they were saying. He caught words, but not meanings. It was not the weird, machine-amplified voice of that woman in the armor. No, God forbid. This was ordinary conversation, real people, and close by. Then he realized that the sounds of conversation were fading. The people were moving away. Panic flared in him, and he suddenly began beating on the floor of the duct, pounding it with his fist and shouting, nearly breaking into tears again. Then the voices were coming back, louder, calling out, demanding to know who he was and where he was. He shouted his name, and that made them yell louder and begin calling instructions. It took 5 forever minutes for them to guide him to an exit vent. As he crawled toward it, the vent was yanked away, filling the duct with light. He looked up to see 3 faces. Faces he knew. Bernie, Sally, and Mark. Not Tex, not support staff. They were security guards in Kevlar vests, and they were all armed. It took everything Benjamin had not to break into tears again. Chapter 29. The Pierce Tower, 58th floor. Mike Castro screamed. So did the gigantic bear. The creature staggered as if it hit a wall, and Castro stared in dumb incomprehension as red poppies seemed to blossom in the center of the bear's mighty chest. More than would be possible from the shots he'd fired. It made no sense. The blubber rippled, and the animal screeched, pawing at the growing circle of red. It was only then that the sound of gunfire other than his own pushed through the shock and terror and registered in Castro's awareness. The bear sagged backward against the housing of the massive gateway machine, and then slowly, so slowly, slumped down to the floor, its eyes registering a profound animal astonishment. It sat for a moment, swaying, and then toppled forward. Castro had to scramble out of the way or be trapped under a ton of slack ursine meat. Then he turned very slowly, as if moving in a dream, and saw a figure crouching in the gaping hole where a shutter had been blown out by the second pulse. The man was a stranger, and yet oddly familiar, like someone he'd never met but had seen on TV or... Then he remembered where he'd seen that face, and with that memory came a name. It was Abby Corman's boyfriend, David Bailey. There were pictures of him in her office. The same David who did those deep core fitness workshops online, Castro had sweated along with in his living room. It was how he'd lost 20 pounds over the last 18 months. Now, insanely, he was there in the window of the 58th floor, a heavy automatic in his fist, smoke curling from its barrel. David? Chapter 30. The Pierce Tower, 53rd floor. Sloane clambered down from the vent and stood trembling on the floor of the landing. There was no one here. Behind her, the 2 lab technicians grunted and cursed their way out of the tight duct. What were their names? She had to pick those up from the small plastic tags pinned to their soiled lab coats. Broussard and Shan, both in their late 30s or early 40s. The black man was burly and looked strong. The Asian was slender but appeared nimble. Both qualities could be useful. The word minions floated through her mind, and despite everything, Sloane nearly smiled. She'd always wanted minions, or lackeys. She wasn't sure what the difference was. "Open that," she said, pointing to the heavy security door, next to which was a keypad. Chan stepped up and examined it, then shook his head. He pointed to an open plexiglass box on the hinge side of the door, in which was a big red plastic button. "Someone hit the manual lockdown. I don't think we should go in." "He's right, ma'am," agreed Broussard. "Maybe one of those things came down the stairs on the other side. Look, see here?" He knelt and poked at some translucent strands, then withdrew his hand. The strands stuck to his finger, and he had a hard time scraping them off on the wall. "Whatever this is, it must have gotten caught and cut off when the door closed." "What is it?" asked Chan. "Looks like spider webs." "Don't be ridiculous," snapped Sloane. "It's far too big to be..." Her words died on her lips, though. Now was not the time to make statements about what could and could not be. And then, before she could say something else, there was a heavy thump on the opposite side of the door. Not an attack, per se. More like something was thrown against it. A moment later, there was a hissing sound, very faint through the closed door, that sounded for all the world like bacon frying, or something melting in a strong chemical reaction. She backed slowly away. So did Shannon Broussard. They looked at each other.
Stairs, suggested Broussard.
And right damn now, agreed Sloane.
Shan beat them to the fire tower door and pushed it open, holding it for the others.
Hey, said Broussard, give me a sec.
He broke the safety plastic over a fire axe and pulled it from the clips, smiling at the weight and potential of it. He held it with one hand like someone familiar with such tools. His grip adjusted for leverage. Sloane tried to go down the stairs first, but Broussard used his left hand to catch her by the shoulder. She immediately wheeled on him, slapping his hand away, vile words rising to her mouth. But she bit them back as the big man stepped clear, hands held up, palms out in a non-problem gesture.
Oh, sorry, Doc, said Broussard quickly. Didn't mean to hurt you.
You didn't hurt me, said Sloane, forcing her tone to be normal. I dislike being touched.
The by people like you was unsaid. But from the look in the man's eyes, he clearly read the message. His benign expression hardened, and for a moment it looked like he, too, wrestled with what he wanted to say. What he actually said was,
"We don't know what's down there."
He pointed to the stairwell. Below them, a third of the landings were in darkness.
"We don't know how far this has spread. Tom and I are just techs. We don't know how to shut the system down. I'm thinking you do. So it's up to the two of us to keep you safe."
She studied his face, looking for deception, for some kind of scam. She saw some anger and contempt, both of which meant less than nothing to her, but no guile.
"Yes," she said, "that's quite correct. Only I can shut this down."
She stood aside and let Broussard go first. There was a brief exchange of knowing glances between him and Chan, but Sloane didn't care much about that either. They crept down the stairs. Chapter 31. The Pierce Tower, 53rd floor. The hunter walked through a jungle inside the tower. Even for her, this was strange. The jungle was complete, as if a biosphere had been carefully curated within the walls of this floor. She could see the room that it had been, analytics, so much like the one on her home world, even down to certain models of computers and art on the walls. Close, but not exact. And that was the most maddening thing in all of this. It was encouraging and frustrating in equal measures. Things sprang out at her, bizarre animals and insect forms, lobsters with tentacles, earthworms thicker than her wrist, snapping with mouths filled with teeth. Many variations of arachnids and stinging flies seemed intent on attacking everything. And there were tragic mutations as well, a thing like a puppy, hairless, blind, barely able to walk, wriggled through the grass as bright red spiders nipped at it. A snake with a broken spine flopped helplessly among the ferns. A creature, vaguely human, but no larger than a doll, ran screaming in terror as scorpions chased it. The hunter kept her pack close and her spear ready. Every now and then she used her suit's built-in speakers to emit a piercing whistle that sent most of the creatures fleeing for cover. A few, too stubborn or with some ability to resist the destructive decibel levels, became enraged and attacked. But as they came flying, crawling, or running toward the source of the sound, the hounds tore them to bloody rags. Along the way, she found corpses, nearly a dozen, or perhaps more. It was hard to tell given how little of each there was. The most complete body was the one closest to the exit, a man who had a name tag that read, A. Burke. His face was missing, though, and red spiders scampered away from the cooling meat as the pack approached. Then a movement made her turn, thinking it was another creature trying to attack. It was not. There, crouched down behind a jasmine bush, was a woman with straight dark hair and bloodstains on her face. The pack immediately surrounded her, but the hunter called to them to stop.